Blog Talk Radio.
Leslie, this is Miles Jackson calling from Honolulu.
Hello, Professor Miles Jackson. We have somebody else on the phone. Do you want to introduce yourself, or you just want to listen in?
Listen to the other person? Or
No, somebody else. We just want to know who this is on the phone.
I see. Uh-huh. Well, this, who? Yeah.
Is anybody on the phone?
I am, Brenda Pitt.
Oh, okay. Hi, Brenda.
Hi.
Professor Miles Jackson, she's going to co-host. This is Brenda.
Oh, okay, fine. She's going to co-host. All right.
Okay, yes. I wanted to be sure it was her before I introduced her. Okay.
Yeah. I have a little technical question before you begin, Leslie. Mm-hmm. My wife wants to watch this on the computer screen. Now, what? Technically, should I just touch play? I mean, are you broadcasting now?
Yes, we're live right now.
We're live.
All right. Can she go to the blog? Is she on the website, the blogtalkradio.com?
Blog, wait a minute. Let's see. Blog, no, probably not. Let's see. I'll get that. I'm in front of the computer, too. Okay.
While you guys are working on connecting to the internet is blogtalkradio.com.
Okay, blog.
/the antique.
Okay.
Capital E show, and you should be able to connect. Now, Brenda is here tonight. I'm so glad you're able to join us. Brenda is a descendant of someone who helped John Brown out in the Harper's Ferry raid.
Oh, okay.
She will be on the show in a couple of weeks to celebrate the John Brown Harper's Ferry raid.
Yeah.
Okay. So are you ready, Professor?
Oh, yes. Yes,
okay.
I'm ready. Uh-huh.
All right. Okay, Professor. First, introduce yourself to the audience and let them know about Honolulu and the university and things of that nature.
Okay. Hello, audience. My name is Miles M. Jackson, and I reside in Honolulu, Hawaii, on the island of Oahu. And I've been here with my family for 35 years or something like that. And I retired from the university in 1995. And I retired as a full professor and a dean. So my title is Professor and Dean Emeritus from the University of Hawaii. And basically, we raised the children in the island. Well, not completely, because several of them were grown when we arrived here. But we had lived in the South Pacific in the early 60s. We lived in American Samoa, in Pongo Pongo, American Samoa, for a couple of years. In fact, our youngest daughter, Malia, was born in Pongo Pongo, American Samoa. So basically, I have been involved in researching the history of African Americans in Hawaii, starting back to before 1800. And I have published two books, and I've written any number of articles. The first book was published in 2001. It's called And They Came, and it's an annotated bibliography also. It's a brief history of blacks in Hawaii, including an annotated bibliography. And the second book was published in 2005, They Followed the Trade Winds, and that was published by the University of Hawaii Press. And so they have the two books that have been published on this subject, the only books that have been published on the history of blacks in Hawaii. Now I'm involved in post-production of a documentary film that we have almost finished editing. We accumulated so much footage, but it is expected to be shown, premiered, during Black History Month in 2010. And also, it's going to be shown on Public Broadcasting Hawaii. Hopefully, it will be picked up and be shown nationally by the National PBS network.
Now, Professor, what led you to Hawaii?
Well, I was hired by the University of Hawaii. I was working with the State University of New York before I came to Hawaii, and before that, I was in Atlanta. I was at Atlanta University, and before that, we lived in American Samoa for a few years. But before that, I was at Hampton Institute. I was the head librarian at Hampton Institute from 1958. Until 1962. So it's just that I was recruited to come to Hawaii because of my specialization. Basically, I'm not a historian. I'm really a librarian, a professional librarian, and that's where I built my career, organizing and administering academic libraries. So that's how I ended up at Hampton, and that's how I ended up at Atlanta University. And so I came to the Pacific as a consultant in American Samoa for the U.S. Department of the Interior. And so that's how I became introduced to Hawaii and the Pacific, and South Pacific in particular. So that's a brief story of how I happened to have gotten here with my family.
Okay, now, Hampton, for our audience who are not familiar with Hampton, HBCUs, And Brenda, you could chime in on
okay,
this question.
Okay, go ahead.
Are there any parallels between Hampton Institute and what you learned and uncovered about Hawaii, African Americans?
Well, there's one thing. There's one thing that I learned before I even came to Hawaii, that the founder of Hampton Institute was General Samuel Chapman Armstrong, who was born and raised in the Hawaiian Islands. He was the son of missionaries who came to Hawaii in the early 1800s. And so he was born and was raised here, did his private school education, and then he went to the mainland to one of the New England private colleges. And then the Civil War broke out. And while the Civil War was underway, he joined the Union Army. And while he was in the Union Army, he was in command of an all-black Union regiment. And so that's how he became interested in the cause of blacks and slavery and the post-Civil War era. And so he was asked by the American Missionary Association to establish this school in Hampton, Virginia, for freed slaves, recently freed slaves, in fact, and this would have been about 1866, 1867. And so that's how I knew about Hawaii's connection to Hampton Institute, through General Armstrong. And I should add also that some of the vocational schools that were established in Hawaii for Hawaiians was based on the principle of Hampton Institute. In other words, General Armstrong's influence, of course, is known in Hawaii, and that is Hampton Institute. Now, Hampton University, of course.
Right. Now, what is the connection with Booker T. Washington and Hampton?
Well, Booker T. Washington was a graduate of Hampton. And Booker T. Washington, of course, was born in West Virginia and had heard about this new school that had been established in Virginia. And he literally walked from West Virginia to Hampton and sought enrollment and was given the opportunity. And so he graduated from Hampton. And when he graduated, he taught school for a couple of years. And then he was asked by the same missionary group that was involved with Hampton Institute if he would be willing to go to Alabama to start this trade school, which ended up being Tuskegee Institute, which is patterned on Hampton Institute, the same philosophy and so forth. So that's the connection with Hampton Institute that Booker T. Washington had.
Now, how I met you is because I learned about Miss Betsy Stockton. Can you explain to the audience about Betsy Stockton?
Oh, yes. Well, Betsy Stockton was born in New Jersey in the early 1800s. And in the 1700s it would have been. And she came to Hawaii in 1810. She was a black woman who was actually born a slave. And she was a slave in a family of Christian missionaries. And so when the missionaries had a chance to come to Hawaii as a part of their commitment to education for those who didn't have the opportunity, Betsy Stockton came with a family to Hawaii. And she came as a teacher because she had been emancipated by that time. And she came to the islands with the family, with the Stuart family, S-T-U-A-R-T. And they were here for several weeks. And then they were transferred to the island of Maui. And that's where Betsy Stockton established a school. It was the first school for commoners, and that is because most of the schools that had been established by the missionaries were established for the sons and daughters of royalty, of chiefs. And so she established the first school for Hawaiian youth who did not come from chiefly families. So, but unfortunately, her stay was not as long as she had hoped it would be, because the family that she came with, the woman of the family,
right, Stewart, right?
Pardon, yeah, the Stewart family, became ill, and Betsy felt that she would do better by going back to New Jersey with the family. And so she only stayed here for a little bit over 2 years. But interesting enough, she was able to establish a school. And in her first few months here, she studied the Hawaiian language, and she learned to speak Hawaiian, and was really on her way to making a major contribution to education in Hawaii. Nevertheless, she did make a contribution, because she did establish the school on Maui for commoners. So that's the Betsy Stockton story.
And she was also educated by the Princeton president.
That's right. That's right. Yes, that's correct. She was connected to the Princeton president family in Princeton, New Jersey. That's correct.
And she was enslaved by Stockton. The Stockton family.
Yeah, right.
There's a school in New Jersey named Stockton College.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that. Well, you were in Philadelphia, so you would know. Yeah. Well, yeah, Betsy Stockton, she's well known in the islands, and because she did make a contribution. And after she returned to New Jersey, she still made a contribution to education on the East Coast in New Jersey. And I understand later she went up to Canada for a short while.
Yes, her school is still sitting in Princeton, New Jersey.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's part of the church. Okay, now your film, will you touch on people like Betsy Stockton and Armstrong?
Yeah.
Okay.
What is your film about?
Well, the film is it's intended to be a depiction of the African-American presence in the islands. We're not calling it a straight history. We decided that we wouldn't do a straight chronological history. We'll leave that for someone else to do. We do touch on the beginnings of African-Americans in Hawaii. In other words, Anthony Allen certainly came here prior to Betsy Stockton. In fact, he was here. He came in 1811. So we're giving the historical background of African-Americans in the islands. We touch on Betsy Stockton, we touch on Anthony Allen, and we talk about the Cape Verdeans who jumped ship in the islands. They were seamen that had been picked up in New England to join the whaling fleets that were in the Pacific. And so a lot of them left their ship.
That's what I was talking to you.
Hello?
We're still here.
Yeah. So am I making sense here now? I mean,
yes.
I'm trying to give you a quick rundown. But anyway, we do have a history of Cape Verdeans, as you know, who come from who consider themselves Africans and are Africans, in fact. The film then moves into talking about African Americans in Hawaii during World War I. That would be before 1920, because we had a large contingent of military, all black units that were sent to Hawaii, and some of them were garrisoned here, but later went on to the Philippines with the occupation there. And then we deal with World War II, the African-American presence here with the military and civilian war workers that were in Hawaii during those times. That would be between 1941 and 1945.
Now, are there any traces of the school systems that Armstrong started in Hawaii? Like, can you really see where his model came from in Hawaii?
There's one school here that is for Hawaiians called the Kamehameha Schools. Kamehameha Schools, and it consists of three campuses, two on this island and one on the island of Maui, I believe it is. And those would be certainly connected with the missionaries' influence there. The Kamehameha schools are privately run, and they run from K through 12. And they only Hawaiian, people of Hawaiian ancestry, can be admitted to those schools. And the school itself, the Kamehameha Estate or Bishop Estate, is a very wealthy state. In fact, it's one of the more wealthier estates or foundations in the country. And it's all based on land. They own, I would say, probably up to 40% of all of the land in Hawaii, even today. Most of the land that's occupied by housing or industry or businesses, et cetera, is leased from the Bishop Estate. In other words, when we first came here, an individual could not buy land. You had to lease the land from the Bishop Estate. And, of course, that was loosened a little bit during the early 1980s. So it's a very wealthy estate, and it is directly influenced by the Armstrong family and similar families, missionary families. And it started as a vocational school. They wore uniforms, wore military uniforms like they did at Hampton Institute in Tuskegee. The boys wore the military-type uniforms, and they had drills and had military discipline.
Okay. Brenda, you have any questions?
Yes. Professor, how have African Americans been treated in Honolulu?
Well, Honolulu. Now, do you want to say Hawaii, or do you just want to say Honolulu?
Well, let's say Hawaii.
Okay. That's a little better. The first African-American, first people of African ancestry were warmly welcomed, like all strangers were welcomed by the indigenous people. And that seems to be, you know, a part of the warmth of indigenous people in receiving others. So African-Americans, and it probably is because of skin tone, that probably was a bit of it, but because the Hawaiian people are basically Polynesians, and Polynesians are brown-skinned people, and so the African Americans who came here had no problem in becoming a part of the local communities. In fact, many of the older Hawaiian families here have African ancestry. There's no question about that. These were single men. There were no women that came with the early arrivals, and so they met up and made it with the local women. This was true up until World War II, when we started seeing a lot of military units being stationed here. And as you know, our military, up until about 1947, was a segregated military. So it meant that segregated military units were brought here, black and white units, and they were segregated on the bases. All of the military bases were segregated during World War II. And so the patterns of segregation and discrimination and the attitudes were brought to Hawaii basically during World War II, and the military does have a reputation historically of looking down on people of color in their occupation areas, and And so that's when people of African ancestry experienced the kind of attempts at segregation and discrimination brought by the U.S. military to Hawaii. Now, that has changed. Of course, as we know, the military was integrated, and that has certainly changed. There's nothing like that here today. There's no segregation, no discrimination. Now, I should say that there have been some concerns about pockets of what we would call meanness or treatment by individuals who have been influenced by the media. The media has, and I say this unfortunately, the media has influenced, and particularly television, and MTV, and you know, hip hop has dominated the scene among young people here, and so many of them idolize the African Americans and hip hop culture. I mean, they try to imitate it, and they have fallen right into it, like many other young people throughout the world. But what has really startled me and startled many of the people in my generation, the old timers here, is how they have adopted the N-word. Now, the N-word, of course, is rampant in the early hip-hop vocabulary and the music. And it has been adopted, or it was adopted. We don't find the problem too much today now, but I can remember being in a gasoline station, and two young Hawaiians greeted each other, and they couldn't see me because I was pumping gas, but I heard them greet each other, and they greeted each other, "How you doing, my N?" You know, my N, shaking hands and giving all kinds of hand signs, signals, and everything. This kind of thing disturbs many of us. This is not speaking to discrimination, as you say, how they're treated, but it shows that they have taken the negative aspect of African American culture, subculture, and they have used it not maliciously. That's the other thing. When I spoke to my son about this, who is a musician, he said, "Well, they don't mean anything by it. You know, they'd use it just like, you know, just like African-American youth would use it on the mainland when they greet each other. I mean, that's the, you know, that's just the way it is." So that does exist here, and it's probably true other places, too. Anyway, I don't know whether I'm answering your question or not. I'm probably...
Well, you are. Yeah. From your experience, then, given that Hawaii is so isolated from, like, the United States,
yes,
and that a number of the African Americans who were there mixed with local people,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
I would imagine their experience is very different than someone in the U.S.
Oh, right? Yes. Oh, yes, yes.
So they probably see themselves quite differently than on the mainland.
Yeah. Well, you know, my last book, I talk about, I call it The Rainbow People. And I take the marriage certificate statistics, and I analyze those. And more than 60% of the black males who married, who applied for marriage licenses, married individuals other than their own ethnicity. If you understand what I mean, and that included the whole range of people. You know, Polynesians, Samoans, Hawaiians, some Japanese, Chinese. I mean, just a whole gamut of ethnicities would be included in that group of individuals that black males married. And so, which means that, you know, when they have children, that are going to be mixed. Now, if the couple marry, and if they raise the children in their household, it's left up to the, you know, to the father if he's African American, to raise his children to be conscious and aware of their roots and who they are, you see.
Right.
But the dilemma does arise with many of the youth who come from that kind of a marriage. They also have, if they have a Japanese or Hawaiian mother or Filipino mother, then they feel an obligation to identify, you know, with that part of their family. And if they are raised in a household with the wives or the mother's family, they might get a preponderance of cultural activity that would not be black, if you follow. Yeah. Let me give you another example. I have a friend of mine at the university when I first arrived in the mid-70s, who told me that he would like to take me to lunch. He was a colleague at the university. And bless him, he's passed now. But his name was, last name was Choi, C-H-O-Y, which is a Chinese last name. And as we ate, we had an opportunity to talk about our background and families and so forth. And I was very interested in his background because he attended Kamehameha School, which is a school I described earlier for individuals of Hawaiian ancestry. And so he said, "Yes, Miles." He says, I'm what you'll find quite a bit of around here. I'm a Chinese Hawaiian." And I said, "Oh, great, great." I said, "Do you identify as a Hawaiian or Chinese?" He says, "Well," he says, "all of my education was at, until I went to the university, was at Kamehameha Schools, and it was Hawaiian, and I speak Hawaiian, and so I was always considered Hawaiian, played football at high school and all." He said, "But after I graduated, I married a Chinese woman, and my father died when I was in high school, and my mother remarried, and she married Chinese." And he said, "So today I consider myself Chinese." He says, I'm really Chinese." He said, "That's my identity." Well, you'll find that to be true throughout the islands.
Right.
There will be individuals who have Japanese Caucasian ancestry, and they will identify themselves as Japanese. Depends on how they were raised and the influence of their parents. Or they will consider themselves Caucasian. You know, whatever they, as you know, the last census, you identify, you say who you are, what you are. You know, you declare your own ethnicity. And so there are lots of people in Hawaii who declare themselves that way. And there are even black Hawaiians who declare themselves Hawaiian, and there are some who declare themselves black, you know.
So why do they have a need to declare themselves anything?
Well, that's a good question. Well, the census, of course, asks people, you know, to identify yourself. And then you identify yourself in your social movements, in your associates. You know, people have a tendency to identify with something of their heritage, the family, and if they come from a biracial family, or in Hawaii, it's sometimes triracial, or there could be four ethnicities in an individual's background. They identify with, you know, whoever has the greatest influence. You know, there might be Chinese this year and Hawaiian next year, you know. So
it sounds a little bit like New Orleans. Is it any similarities?
Well, I'm familiar with New Orleans somewhat, but I think it's probably a little more complex than New Orleans. I think it's a little more complex.
Would it be more like Brazil?
It might be more like Brazil, but in Brazil, skin tone does play a great role. The little I have read about Brazil, but Brazil, of course, does have quite a mixture of mostly Portuguese and African and indigenous people.
Right.
But I think the Hawaii is a little more complex than that. It's a little more complex than that. Um,
Well, was there ever slavery?
No slavery. Never slavery. No, the Hawaiians have it in there, you know, in the before 1893, before the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy was here, before the Americans overthrew the Hawaiian government. They had in the legislature that there could be no slavery because they had the sugar industry here, and the planters that came were mostly white planters, and some of them had southern experience, plantation experience, and so they were adamant in their legislative dealings that there would be no kind of slavery. The closest thing to it would be contractual labor, where they contracted. You know, the Filipinos and Chinese and Japanese and various ethnic groups to come here to work on the plantations. Even blacks were recruited from Alabama and Tennessee in the early 1900s to work on the plantations. That's another story, and I write about that in my books.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any differentiation based on color, like, even in countries such as China, people, the lighter you are, the more opportunities you have.
I follow what you're saying. Yeah, because we have scholars at our East West Center, and I do know those that have spent time in China, and who do talk about the treatment of the indigenous Chinese who are really darker skin tone, but. I suspect that the influence of the dominant race during the early part of the 1800s and the influence of European influence has caused this kind mistreatment of people who are of darker skin tone, and that may be closer to it than we would say out discrimination.
Right.
But I do know personally that there are Hawaiians that I have known who have members of the family who are of different coloration, and they have literally sometimes joked and poked fun at members of the family who are darker.
Mm.
Yeah, that has happened. But when I first discovered this was something that was done, they laugh and say, "Oh, that, you know, that's nothing. You know, we don't really mean anything by it." So, you know, there is some. I can't deny this, and it can't be denied that there has been some beneath the surface discrimination, or I'm reluctant to say discrimination. It's not the right word.
But preferential treatment.
Preferential treatment. That's the word. Thank you very much. Against individuals who might be of darker skin tone. That you know, and that could be Hawaiians against Hawaiians. And we you know, we're, as African American, as an ethnicity, we're familiar with that. So yeah, that does run true among the Hawaiians and Chinese too.
Now we're down to our last 5 minutes of the show.
Oh wow! I don't know whether what a time.
I would like for you to talk more about the logistics of your film. What influenced you to get this film started?
Well, when I completed They Follow the Trade Winds, I became friends with Steve Occhino, who is the filmmaker in the project. And he had just completed an award-winning film, A Most Unlikely Hero. I know we don't have much time, but anyway, we became friends, and I talked to him about the possibility, gave him a copy of the book, both books, in fact, and talked to him about the possibility of would he take an interest in maybe collaborating on a film. And he did, and so he thought it was a good idea. And so we embarked on this project about 4 years ago. So this project has been underway for a long time, like documentary films, independent, that don't have any money, and we're raising money right at this moment. So, okay. But that's basically it. That's how the
film. Now, how can someone get in touch with you and donate money for your film?
Okay, we have a website. We have a website, and it's let me give you that right now. It's holding fast the dream. Holdingthedream.org. Holdingthedream.org. That's our webpage, and we have a PayPal there, and then individuals can contribute through through PayPal.
Okay. Now, how did the Hawaiians receive President Obama's campaign and
fantastic. It was fantastic. You know, he got 98% of the vote in Hawaii.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. He's very popular here. Very, very popular.
Can you just describe, explain to us the scene and your personal experience on the local television? Just to let, I know we were able to see what was going on in Kenya, but I don't remember seeing anything about Hawaii. Do you, Brenda?
No.
Okay. So can you be our eyes and explain and describe to us what it looked like in Hawaii the night of the inauguration? And
Well, of course, I was at home in front of the television. Uh-huh. But I can tell you when we had the voting on the day we voted.
Election Day, right?
Election Day. Uh-huh. The lines were wrapped around the corner, around the block. There were people who were standing outside. My understanding is people who had never voted before voted. And they were all excited about Obama. People wearing Obama T-shirts, Obama caps. My wife tells the experience she had in the drugstore, and Hawaiian man touched her. He was behind her and touched her on the shoulder and said, we won. So, the local population was overwhelmingly supportive and still are of Obama.
Were there gathering places like, in Chicago, they were meeting at the parks. There were people all over the world gathering to watch the results on election night.
Oh, I'm sure they were. Yes, they were. In fact, Obama had just been here the summer. He came in August, and we filmed with him. If you look at the website, you'll see that we have footage that we, because we have a trailer with the website, so be sure to look at that. And it opens with Obama. We got press passes and went down and filmed him giving a talk to a mass rally. That would have been probably August of 2008, July, August 2008.
Okay, Brenda, we have 2 minutes. You have any questions before we allow the professor to say goodnight?
No, he's covered all of my questions very well.
And he also answered mine as well. Professor, do you see yourself having a part two to your film, Holding
Well,
On?
It has been so difficult raising funds for this one-hour documentary. And the reason it's 1 hour is because the PBS specified that, they could only show if it's 56 minutes and so many seconds. And the money, we have a budget of $120,000, and we've raised about $75,000, and we're looking for about 15 to 20,000. That's what we think we'll get it. But if it's going to be a first-class documentary, you've got to have professional people doing it, and all of our the camera people we have, the sound, the editor, they all are professional people here in Hawaii, and they have to be paid. They ask for union wages, but we had to negotiate that. So we have a budget, and I just don't know whether I would have the energy to do a sequel to this. But we are talking about, we have enough footage to have about a 90-minute DVD, which would be just as good.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the film.
And check the website out. Check the webpage, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, and hopefully we'll be able to see the film here in the mainland.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. I hope that it gets picked up by National PBS, because it will be shown here in early 2010.
Okay, would you just reintroduce yourself to the audience, and we'll close the show off with your introduction and all your contact information.
Okay. I'm Miles M. Jackson, residing in Hawaii for 35 years or so. Been in the South Pacific in a number of years. In the Navy, I was stationed here. I'm a retired professor and Dean Emeritus from the University of Hawaii. I did my educational work undergraduate at Virginia Union University in Richmond. I did a master's at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and a PhD in communication at Syracuse University.
All right. And your website again?
My website is holdingthedream.org.
Excellent. Well, you've been a wonderful guest. I'm looking forward to inviting you on the air to talk to us once your film has been broadcasted in Hawaii. And Brenda, I want you to also reintroduce yourself to the audience, and we'll call tonight.
Okay. I'm Brenda Pitts, and I am a descendant of John Anthony Copeland, who was with John Brown at Harper's Ferry. And I've been working on the family history for about 9 years now. And
I've
come to learn not only a lot about myself, but also a lot about the whole abolitionist movement and people of color in the United States. Prior to that, I spent a number of years actually doing diversity and affirmative action in a corporate environment for a Fortune 500 company. So it's been a passion of mine for several years.
Good, good.
All right. Again, this show was a great show. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Miles M. Jackson, Dean of Emeritus of the University of Hawaii. We're looking forward to seeing your film.
Okay, and thank you very much, too. One question. Is this archived on your site?
Yes.
Is the interview archived? Okay, good, good.
Yes, it is. You can listen to it, and you'll probably get a lot of activity in the next 2 weeks is usually when we see the most activity.
Okay.
So I'll be in touch with you soon to
okay.
let you know just how your show is doing as far as
okay.
downloads. So.
Nice meeting you too, Brenda.
Nice meeting you too.
Okay.
Thank you
care.
So much.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye, Leslie.
Bye-bye.